Hi there, this is Brian Smith speaking to you from the future. Apologies for the sound quality on this episode of Let's Go. Dwayne was in the process of moving house and he did not have his normal microphone available. And so he sounds like he's recording it from inside a tin can. Tried to get the levels as best I can, but it still is a pretty weak sound on Dwayne's end. But for continuity's sake, I had to get the episode out. There'll be two more episodes in quick succession, which have hopefully much better sound quality to them. Enjoy the best you can. You are listening to Let's Go, the weekly anime podcast about weekly anime from Dynamite in the Brain and Secret of the Sailor Madness. So come along and hang with the Let's Go gang. It's Dwayne.
Hello.
And it's me, Brian. Niall is in Korea.
The south one.
Yes, where presumably his microphones are probably working better than ours.
The move has fucked me over a bit, yeah.
This week we are talking about the anime that aired the week of the 28th of October. No, the 21st of October 2019. We'll be talking about 28th next week. And to the 27th of October 2019. This may be a trying episode because I've still got a bunged up head even though I'm over the cold.
And I sound like ass because my microphone is in my sister's.
Righty-ho. So, let's take a butcher's. We started off this week with Super Shiro, episode 2, The Wax Snack Factory.
I feel like this is just going to be the standard setup based off the outro as well.
I think you're right, yes.
Oh, I'm all right with that. I'm okay with that. I wasn't expecting I know you said it looked great and everything, but I wasn't expecting the level of quality of the animation. This was rather nice.
Yeah, so this time the bone is in a dog biscuit factory. So Super Shiro must go and investigate and also resist the temptation to eat all these delicious dog biscuits.
Of course, the baddie dog has no such compunctions. Yes. There's a bit of a kerfuffle about that.
Or rather, we should say, he must resist the temptation of the biscuits, baby.
That seems like he's catchphrase, just to say baby at the end of things, isn't it?
Yes, I neglected to mention that last week. If you wanted to hear Akio Tsuka say baby at the end of every single line, this is the show for you.
That's gotta be the show for someone, yeah.
Yeah, and also I forgot because it's the normal voice actress for Shiro does Shiro's outside voice.
Yeah, so that's the one that like answers the phone and is yes. Like, oh, okay, I'll go get the phone. And then it's like, okay, I'm going to get it. Is the internal monologue cool guy voice.
Yeah, and sometimes you hear the internal monologue and it's just barking.
Well, he's a dog, so.
Beside it. I think that, and once again, the bone blows up. I think the highlight is the doe legs in this episode.
That was pretty good. I was getting some wrong trousers looks to that as well. Yeah.
There
were some good chase sequences, and all the conveyor belts reminded me of playing, what was that game called? Big Pharma? Yeah, just wild and wacky chases on conveyor belts.
And also we discover why Dekapu wants the bone. So
he can be the dog president of the world.
That is correct, yes.
I mean, most of his policies are pretty good, but I feel like the dogs will still want to chase after the stick. It's not a power thing, it's that they like doing it.
What's his thing? He's like, all food will become premium dog food. Which will have his face on as well. All the parks will be dog parks.
You don't have to bring your shit home.
Yes.
That's a big one that's going to get him the votes.
And the humans will have to chase bulls.
Yes.
It's a lot of fun. And yeah, of course, he's absolutely sure that this is the bone this time. Which I assume is that's how every single episode is going to end to the final one.
I mean, the variation on it in this one is that he's drooling because it's like, actually, this smells really fucking good and I want to eat it right now, but I must do this for great justice, explodes in his face.
Next week, it's a jewel. Get dazzled by the light, baby. Then, is Blade of Immortal one of yours, or is that just Niall watching that at the moment?
No, I'm still watching that. I'm not going to do it justice, but I'll give it a shot.
Okay, this was Blade of Immortal Act 3 Dream Pangs, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's still doing the fancy acts. I've forgotten all the names, so good job, me. Right, so they're the kind of main character ships to, I guess you'd say, one of the baddies, and is this woman who's torn between, not torn between, but she's like wondering, should I go like a geisha, like my mom said to do, because her mom was a geisha, or should I continue this whole assassinating thing, because I don't know if it's really working out. It's less that lack of confidence in her skill, it's more lack of confidence in her conviction. And she initially has a fight with your man, which, like, I mean, like, she pretends to go up to him as a geisha and is like, hey, stud, how about a little bit of this? And he's like, yeah, okay, and sends the little girl off, and she's all jealous and everything, but he knew it was an assassination attempt, and he kicks her butt pretty handily, and he's kind of, like, berating her lack of skill. It's like, oh, there must be in the bottom of the barrel already, and I've only killed fucking two of them. But then you kind of see a lot of her background and her working through stuff, and the next time she comes after him, she absolutely fucking trounces him. I think she can't finish him the second time, but then the third time she was like basically ready to kill the guy, and the girl managed to talk her out of it by speaking of her convictions as to why she doesn't want to kill, but she has to for reasons, and that kind of cements her thing. And a lot of the episode is basically played really nicely, because there's parts where it shows her playing the is it the shamisen? It's like a guitar that you play with a little piece of I don't know, like a giant plectrum. I don't really know the proper words for it. And she obviously has the it's like a tri-section staff, but with like pike like ends on the end of it that she has hidden in the shamisen. I was like you know, the Tommy gun in the violin case, and I was like, oh, that's pretty rad. A lot of the stuff with her is kind of playing up the very slow-paced scenes in between, like showing her background and stuff like that, and showing that she's torn between, it's like, is killing the right thing to do, or is selling my body the right thing to do? Because, I mean, like, at least that's comfort. It's not really, it's looked down upon and everything, but at least it's making the world better, whereas killing is like, that's another fucking set of issues. And then this really breakneck pace with the fights that are, I think they're all set in like, for the most part, like very narrow, alleys. And there's a real immediacy in like, you can follow them. Some people see, I've read, we're having trouble following them. I'd no trouble, but, it's really quite, exciting, and it kind of, the shamisen starts playing during that, and it's, increases the pace of it. It's very like about the notes and the bits between the notes, like the cam between it, and then the high pacedness of it. Really fucking artful show, really gorgeous to watch. A good episode as well, kind of showing that our hero is like, maybe being immortal and having lots of swords is his main ability, rather than actually being good with them. Cause, he did not look good in this one. Kind of made him look like a punk, alright.
Then we got Null and Petter, episode 4, Big Sister, Do I Have to Go to Space? In which we open with Null in space, and then the rest of the episode is...
You might be wondering how I got here.
Yes. Which, I watched this after Dr. Stone, and I was
yeah,
like...
That would be a weird dissonance, yeah.
So Petter was sending Null to school by... activating a rocket backpack, but then Null was like, ah, I've tricked my big sister, I've got a remote control for it, so I can fly it myself. I don't have to go to school, but oh no.
Use the drones on it to bring her to the sweet shop.
Yes, yeah. Petter was also remote controlling it in a arcade, which then turned her into a, I guess an exit capsule rather than a re-entry capsule.
Yeah.
And sent her to a space station. And then Null's actually, she's like, normally she likes to be alone, but even this is a little bit too much being stuck in space. And then her sister shows up and tries to feed her food. And she's like, no, this will kill me. And then Petter runs out of batteries.
She keeps going back, like, it's like, oh, that'll kill you. It's just he goes back and picks up some noodles or something.
Yes.
Like, basically, it's like, oh, this kind of food will kill you. Let me just fly back to Earth and fly back here. And the back and forth makes her lose batteries after the third trip or something, yeah.
Yeah, we should say it's not the food which will kill her, it's the fact that Petter was trying to open the...
her astronaut helmet.
Yes.
That'll do it.
And now she's alone in space with a sister who's run out of batteries. And I have no idea whether this will be a cliffhanger resolved next week or whether it'll just reset to something else.
It's hard to know with this show, yeah.
Because this is the first time it felt like... I mean, the story's continuing in that the story seems to be...
Trying to go to school.
Get her to go to school, yes. Mm. But yeah, it was a pleasant enough time. But unfortunately, we're now watching Super Shiro through illegal means. And that is better than this.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel like... This feels like it's trying to tug at your heartstrings and has some sort of serious message, whereas Super Shiro is just 5 minutes of cartoon goof-alongs.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, like, I did appreciate Petter showing up in, like, Gundam armor, essentially. It wasn't as good as that freaking crazy chase sequence. I mean, like, if we get more of that, that'd be different.
Yeah. Then did you watch Fire Force?
I did, but I think I might drop it after this.
Episode 14, For Whom the Flames Burn.
Not for me. I might watch it all when it's all out, but, like, again, we're still in the same fucking place, and I was just like, okay, I get it. And there was loads of really cool action sequences. It just feels like, based off the prior episodes, it feels like, okay, we're getting stuff done, and this one really ringing this stuff out. But your man who turned into an infernal, he actually became a demon. I think they say either a demon or Akuma, I can't remember. But he grows horns, and that's a more powerful kind of infernal. And then we have our main guy getting flashbacks to the one that killed his family, which did have horns. And the thing about this infernal, as far as I can tell, is he's super hard. Like, he's very hard to break. Just a solid, solid motherfucker. So that's a bit of a problem. Then our guy, the chief of the fire department in this part of town, he has his kind of moment of rising to leadership, because they're going like, oh, they need a leader, the people are in chaos and that kind of thing. So he takes the entire fire tower that he's on with his second in command, the guy who he wanted to be in command, and he flies it up into the air like a rocket, like four rockets, to get everyone's attention, because that'll do it. And he says, okay, so there's infernals all around town, and nobody knows who to trust because there's a bunch of imposters. So everyone kick the shit out of each other, and we'll start it out in the morning, and the fire department will just fight any infernals or fires. And everyone in town is just like, yeah, and they all just start beating the crap out of each other. And I was like, interesting solution. It was pretty funny, just a bunch of people in town just smiling and just whacking into each other, just a big party kind of brawl kind of thing. And I was like, okay, I guess that'll do it. We kind of have our, Arthur and, goddammit, why can't I think of the main guy's name?
We have those Shinra. Two kind of,
yeah, Shinra, fighting the two, the archer flame user one and the now infernalized, demonized, her partner kind of thing. He still seems to be under control because he's still working with her and everything, so. I don't know if that's part of the conviction or part of being a demon. It's like you can be an infernal with your mind. Although it seems to suggest that some infernals do have their mind intact.
Well, we know that already because of the arsonist from the Division 5 storyline.
Yeah. You're right. There, I mean, like, there's a few examples of them having control or anything. But what ends up happening is our big boy, the fire department guy, decides he sees this infernal, like, exploding, fighting the lads. He's like, that's my target, the big explosion. So he goes for this guy, and he remembered your man's trick the last time where he exploded like a giant, I assume he exploded the infernal, the demon infernal in the ground and lost all his powers or did damage himself doing that. So he's going to do the exact same thing, except he's going to, like, use his crazy flying broomstick trick to knock this guy into the sky and, like, explode him in the air. seems like a good plan because, you know, no casualties in midair, that kind of thing. But the archer one's shooting her arrow and she says, they're like, haha, nothing can move my arrows, that kind of thing. She's been stating to Shinra the entire time that it's just like, hey, you've got the kind of fire that is for destroying humanity. So you should be working with us and that kind of thing. So I'm not exactly sure what that's about, but he superhero flies up to try and deflect the arrow and she's like, you can't do it. He manages to do it, obviously. He exposes the big infernal and Shinra has to catch him because he uses up pretty much all his strength trying to crack this one nut. Everything turns out okay in the end. The information that came to town was destroyed in the chaos, set on fire, obviously. But they have made a staunch ally in the 7th Division of the Fire Force, which is cool. But I'm like, it took so fucking long to get there. And I did enjoy the action sequence and everything, but I feel like this would be a better watch, like back-to-back kind of thing, or at your own pace rather than week-to-week. And again, it's just like, there's so many other good things. That's the other problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, Fire Force, still liking it, still like a lot about it in terms of design and stuff, but just the pace really let up in the last few episodes.
Yeah, and I think that's from the comic, I think. But I don't think it's actually...
I get what you mean, like, but... you know the way, like, in a comic, like, or in an anime adaptation of a comic, it runs through, like, a couple of chapters in an episode, and you're like, oh, that felt good. This felt like... you know the way you could do, like, a volume, a fucking episode, if you're really goddamn good at pace? I just felt like it was, like, really... They really want to get all these scenes in. It felt like some of it needed kind of like an editing chop or something. I'm not exactly sure what happened.
Then we've got Dr. Stone episode
17.
17. Yeah, that sounds about right. And that one is called
A Thousand Skies.
Yeah, well, my mouse behaves itself. Just watched this and I just mopped up all the tears I cried watching it.
I'm not gonna fucking lie, I freaking teared up watching this. This was surprisingly fucking moving, yeah.
Yeah, I think
it's surprising in that I'm just like, wow, that was really effective. Good job, guys.
Yeah, I was surprised because I read the chapters. I reread the chapters during this past week and it didn't have the effect when I was reading them.
The acting, the music, it's paced just fucking right.
Yeah, I think.
Obviously, you set the pacing when you read a thing. That's the difference.
Yeah, I think it's the music and the acting. I think, weirdly, his dad's goofy voice.
Oh, when it broke. Oh,
yes.
Jesus. Yeah,
makes it more compelling. Cause, I never really imagined him with that goofier voice.
even with the way he looks and acts. Okay.
And there's stuff in this that I did pick up second time reading. And here's the weird thing that
sure.
I don't know if you read the first chapter of the side story they're doing.
I don't think so.
No, well, it's in the latest issue of Shonen Jump, if you want to read it, which is a weird retelling of this story. So it's this story again. But there's an extra character. There's an extra character there who wasn't in this version of the story.
Okay.
And I won't spoil what that extra character is, and I don't know whether this is now going to be the canonical version of this story. And really, as so far, that extra character does not affect anything told here. At all.
Right, yeah. I mean, like, I guess you could see it as an editing of history for whatever fucking reason. Or maybe when you're playing telephone, like something got freaking left out in the retelling. Yeah.
Yeah, I won't spoil it because it helps to have seen this version of the story for the effect of the addition to the story to make you go, what are they doing in this story? Why are they retelling it with this?
Okay.
Anyway. So. They're going to go back down to Earth and Dad wants to go and Shamil punches him in the stomach and says, no, you've got a kid. It should be the ones of us who haven't got kids should be the ones to go down first.
He was initially regretful because, like, they only got two capsules for going back down. So even though he wants to go back down, he has to take two people with him. Yes. Yeah.
And he begrudgingly agrees. And the three of them go down, and they get down to Earth, and they're not petrified, but the problem is the capsule lands upside down, and so they can't get out of the capsule. And they're
upside down a few miles off the coast where they were planning on, because they picked the spot furthest away, because they said it was like South America or something.
Yeah.
They picked the spot like, they picked an island furthest away from the source, thinking that it's like, okay, if the petrification is still in effect, we're at the weakest point.
Yeah, this new telling makes that discussion a lot longer.
I thought it was quite sensible, like looking at Twitter and whatnot and seeing when the news stopped essentially.
Yeah, there's more of a debate of where they're going to land in.
Right.
In this version of the story. They're not going to let them die. So they're going to land, and whatever it takes, we'll get a boat. If we even have to build a raft, we'll get there and rescue them. And they do. And, they set up a new settlement. They try and look for a survivor on this island, but unfortunately he's also been petrified and
whatever. But, like, they find one person.
Yes.
Getting closer to
it. Yeah, there must be more people because they mentioned there's farms. Yeah.
Because it looked like a farm or something.
Yeah. And they set up settlement and they, start pairing off, having children. But then, I can't remember her name now, the first one to die.
Oh, crap. Name again, but it's four.
It's the woman from, NASA.
So. Yeah, she's the pigtails.
Yeah, she gets pneumonia and dies. Then.
The couple head off on a boat.
They're going to the mainland. Like, hey,
mind our kids. If we're going to head to the mainland and see if we can find some antibiotics.
Yes. So I wonder if they're the ones who move Senku.
Yeah.
Cause this is the thing I did. These are all these little details of stuff I didn't pick up first time around reading it.
Mm.
Or didn't retain first time around. Cause the other important detail is the village they set up, we see them setting up here is not Ishigawa Village.
This is an island off Japan.
Yes. Yeah. Cause they mentioned in the 100 Tales, there's stuff in it to encourage the descendants of the village to leave here and head to Japan.
And it's because he's so sure that Senku was the guy to sort this out and that this is undoable and that Senku's not actually dead.
Yes.
Which is a weird kind of like, I'm not sure how exactly he knows that, but maybe it's just something to aim for.
Yes. Which gives even after you've had the emotions wrung out of you as you realize everything his dad's done for him. And then that final line of, how are you, Senku? I'm doing all right. Well, I guess I'm not. I'm dead.
I've been dead for thousands of years. But you know what I mean. Like the message where it's just like, just shoot me off a little text here.
Yes. But that's the thing which is going to affect Senku the most at the end is that, he's had all this in the abstract and then all of a sudden he gets hit with this personal message from his dad.
Yeah, to have it told as a tale of legend and passed down and stuff, even if the lines are all 100% right, but just as a message straight to him.
Yes.
That's the bit that hits him.
And it's passed from person to person for thousands of years.
Mm.
And so we finally see him show some other emotion other than glee at...
I like that because like his dad's like, he's like, here's the final gift I'll leave you, Senku, besides like setting all these guys up to be the thing that you need them to be. I'm giving you friends. These will be allies for you.
Yeah. And I do like how
you're going to need them.
You see like the facial resemblances and stuff.
They keep insisting, it's like, don't worry, we weren't blood related, so that he can get on with these people. That's kind of weird.
Well, yeah, because there's the one little bit where when they question whether he's related to them and Kohaku is blushing.
Yeah, well, she's kind of, I'm not sure if it was blushing or disgusted. It's like, oh my god, is he like my grandpa or something, like granduncle?
Yes. But no, he assures them he's not a blood relative and then says, well, even if I was, it's thousands of years, we're not related.
Yeah, genetically we're very different.
Though you can see the resemblance in certain people to
in
the
certain
six.
People, I'm kind of looking at it as like, oh, that's a bit of him, oh, that's a bit of her.
Yes, because Koseki's got kind of like the eyebrows and eyes of the Russian dad.
Hmm. Like, I wasn't sure if I could be fucking completely reading it wrong, but I keep mixing up Kinro and Ginro.
Kinro has the glasses and is the sensible one. Ginro is the lazy, lecherous one.
Well, obviously, like, Kinro has the same hair color as the one from NASA, but like, his eyes kind of look like, is that like Sinku's dad's eyes? You know, the kind of like the sharp eyedness.
Yeah, well, they're all, I mean, it's thousands of years, they're all related to all of them, so.
Yeah, they're all, but you're trying to see which, like, genetic markers are in them, just from character design, which is a really good way of getting around that you only have a few character designs.
Yes, but obviously the fact that the two parents went off and didn't come back suggests that that gives the opportunity for there to be another settlement somewhere.
And that's interesting as well, and it could be meant for a different purpose,
Yeah. And there's other stuff which is important to remember, but I'm not going to tell you what it is because it won't surprise you later on. Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. I got it. I'm going to have to start reading.
Yes.
This.
All I say the issue of the Russian parents going has not come back up. I thought it had, and then there was something here which made me go, okay, no, that's not the case.
Right. Okay.
And there's a specific thing we see in this episode, and I was like, ah, okay, gotcha. Right, now I know. Now I've got my geography of later chapters.
So, like, what's interesting to me about you saying about this thing that I can't be told, otherwise spoilers. The show seems to be doing a really good job of reframing a lot of the context. Because you were saying that before, was it Senku's neck cracking and another thing as well that you're saying is like this is
foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. There's foreshadowing that I'm only picking up on the second time around. And
okay, excellent. That's good.
And it's front and center in this episode. And I was like, yeah, I'd forgotten it, but now I go back and watch it again. I'm like, and maybe they made it more front and center in the anime. I don't know, but
they definitely they did a good job of drawing attention to it or stating it.
Yes. Yeah.
I suppose it's easier since the story's moved on now to do that, but still, yeah. Still being an excellent show, of course.
Yeah, it is very good. Then we move on to My Hero Academia, episode 66, Boy Meets... ...
Not a very powerful episode.
Well, I mean, essentially, I assume you watched after the credits.
Question whether I did now.
Because I would say...
Oh, I did, yes.
Because essentially, it's Boy Meets Plot. Here comes the plot running down an alleyway right at him.
I was literally watching the outro. I was like, huh, I wonder when they're going to bring in that little girl. And I was like, oh, okay, now. That's the way I remember watching it. And I was just like, oh, hopefully they don't leave that too long. I'm interested in what this character is about. It's like straight away. Okay, cool.
Yeah. My wild prediction is that by the end of the series, Deku has given that little girl the one for all.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's my wild prediction. That's my current wild prediction.
All right. The plot kind of goes to her that much, eh?
Yeah, she's kind of important to the plot. She is the center of this story.
Oh, okay.
That's why she's in the end credit. That's why the end credits are dedicated to
her. I'm very focused on her, so I figured she was important, at least, if not to this story, then to this part of the arc.
Yeah, this is why I said last week that this is the one arc which is a bit like Black Clover, where it gets straight to the plot, because the plot just literally runs into Deku.
Well, I mean, like, to be fair, like, by the end of the episode, they are looking for the plot, and then the plot runs into them, so, yeah.
This is basically, the bulk of the episode is Sir Night Eye trying to determine whether Deku, is right to join him because he thinks the power should have been given to, and I'm going to forget his name every week, I should really write it down, Dot-Eyed Boy.
Tintin, dear, yeah, I've forgotten his name again.
Yeah. Anyway, him. He thinks he's the guy for him to be the next All Might. And so, basically...
And I mean, like, yeah, he's even suggesting, like, hey, like, I know how All For One works. You know how All For One works. You could make this happen.
Yes.
Except not saying it, obviously.
Yeah, so he's basically, why should I hire you? Also, it's kind of like he's... Also explaining, like, yeah, I've got everybody I need. I don't need another person.
Yeah.
That's his initial challenge to him.
You can't explain. Yeah. You can't make me laugh. You can see from his room that he's a super All Might fan. So I was like, ugh.
Well, yeah.
They have a long conversation over,
yeah, he just
starts like, I was trying to do this kind of stuff.
Yes.
Because the darkness of your eyes isn't quite the right shape. It's between this and this. And I was like, I was going for this one because it's a really funny thing he did. He had a really cool line. A particular event that wasn't popular in the forums. I was just like, and they're basically fanning out together. And I was like, okay, he's making a connection. But anyway, can't make Sir Night Owl laugh. He has all the fucking guys he needs. He already has a fucking intern. So if you can't demonstrate to him why you're necessary, why should he shouldn't really hire you.
Yeah. And I do like, this is done very well with the tapping of the stamp. On the table when he's explaining, like, if I want to hire you, I've got to stamp this form, and why should I? And then basically challenges him to try and take the stamp off me and stamp it yourself.
Yeah, you got 3 minutes. Go.
Yes.
If you can, then I'll absolutely fucking hire you.
Deku's like, oh, I've got to figure out how his power works. And he's like, oh, no, I've only got 3 minutes. I can't figure out, so I've got to figure out how his power
works. He knows how his power works, except as Sir Nighteye says about the commentator, it's like he doesn't know the conditions of how his power works or how long he can use it for, that kind of way.
Yes, we're into JoJo's territory, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep. I love it. I got a rough idea of how your shit works, but not exactly. And I did like Sir Nighteye interrupting the commentator, going like, the conditions of my power are fucking classified, so shut the fuck up.
So his powers are that he has to touch the target and then make eye contact, and then once he's done that...
And he was messing with Deku's face, and yes. He obviously was staring at fucking daggers into him the entire time, so... Yeah.
He can see the entirety of that target's future for 1 hour.
Yeah. Which is like, that's interesting. So he even knows where Deku's gonna be by the end of the fight, and he states it partway through where it's like, yeah, you're gonna be on your knees at the end of 3 minutes, without the stamp in your hand. I know that much. Cause I've already seen it.
He has a long challenge. He goads Deku throughout, basically saying, well, you're like a crap Gran Torino.
Yeah, like he's knocking it. It's like, oh, you're taking the direct approach, but obviously you're going to make this move. Like anyone can see that you're obviously cribbing on Gran Torino, but you're not as good as him. Obviously, you know, just really like tearing him a new one, trying to get him to quit. Essentially, trying to get him to give up the power to someone more worthy.
Yeah, I do like how the pair of them outside have clearly been timing the 3 minutes themselves, because as soon as the 3 minutes is over, they come straight back in the room again.
Yeah, they're great the whole time, because obviously the guy whose name we keep fucking forgetting, like, he just unclasps your one, and, you know, it's just like, yep, this is just fucking Tuesday at the office. They kind of go out, they get a drink at the soda machine, and then they kind of hop back in. It's just like, this is normal to them. they're used to the boss at this stage. It's funny how normal this is to them, yeah.
Mirio Tagata, that's the fella.
Mirio, okay.
Mirio, yeah. Yes, and so then Deku thinks he's failed, but he goes and stamps it anyway. Because he's like, I never said that was the condition for me hiring you, I just challenged you to do it.
Yeah, I said I would if you could do it, I didn't say I wouldn't if you couldn't, that's different. And you don't see him laugh, but you do hear like a little laugh when he has a hand up to his face.
Yeah.
Because Deku was like, I probably could have got it if I'd stomped on that limited edition, not released for the public consumption, All my 10-year anniversary poster. And then he kind of looks around the room and was like, wait a minute, you fucked up my room and threw my paperwork everywhere, but you didn't damage all of my All Might merchandise.
Yeah, and this
okay,
is...
You're okay.
This is where he gets the explanation, though. And yes, if you work alongside Mirio, then you're going to realize that you should give that power to him.
Yeah, he thinks that if he works here, he'll see that he's unworthy of the power. This is trying to, working here is proof that he'll give it up, and that's still Nighteye getting what he wants.
And of course, because Mirio is the right person for the power, he's never going to ask for it himself.
Yeah, also he's this sound out nice guy, so, yeah.
And then also we get a little bit with the other guys at school, wondering where they're going to go to work.
They're saying, like, oh, the guy I intern with, they don't take on, or the guy I... work study with, they don't take interns, that kind of thing.
Your dark bird fella has been picked up by hawks. We first glimpse of hawks.
Is that just to keep a Burn theme going? It's like, oh, a Burn theme kid.
No, yeah, that's to introduce incredibly important character Hawks into the story.
Okay, cool.
So,
I thought it was just the name thing. It was kind of a joke.
No, this is for people who have been reading the comic to go, oh, there's Hawks.
Okay, excellent.
He's kind of in the Endeavor role now of being the second most important pro hero.
Okay.
Whereas Endeavor's now the most important pro hero.
The guy trying to climb the ranks rather than the guy who's now at the top.
Oh, well, no, he literally, because they mentioned he's number three hero here, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you can tell, I think when they finally get around to redoing the ranks, then he's automatically in number two and Endeavor's in number one because number one's not there anymore. So yeah, I can't remember if that was in this bit of the comic or whether this is here because he's in the movie and they've got to promote the movie.
Yeah, I suppose it could be.
And then, the others have been told to go and see the other two of the, three Wunderkind superheroes at school to go and speak to them to see, cause they can get them.
Well, they said they'd get onto it tomorrow, but like, Kirishima's kind of like, why can I always fucking remember his name? He's like, yes. I'm going to fucking see them right now. I'm just going to go over to their dorm. And yes. The, two girls are also like, oh yeah, we could just fucking go over. Yeah.
They're like, oh yeah, we're in the opening credits as well. We should go.
They're important characters.
We're going to be in this story.
Yeah.
Even if, the people who normally are in this story aren't because they're busy having to relearn for their exams again.
I did like that repeated joke. That did get funnier every time they did it. We got a lot of catching up to do. It's like, shut the fuck up, dude. Shut up.
As the comic goes on, they make more and more of the fact that Shoto is, while he's super powerful and really good at being a superhero, he does apparently seem to lack the observational skills that some of the other characters have.
I can't be good at everything, I suppose, yeah.
Because they're kind of like, how has he not worked out that Deku's got All Might's powers yet?
He's got a lot of his own shit going on, I guess.
He does, so, yes.
Yeah.
Hey, next chapter of the comic is Endeavor's daughter inviting them all to a family dinner, so.
Oh, God. That's either going to be hilarious or awkward or both.
Yeah, because basically in the comic at the moment, it's Deku and Shoto and Bakugo are doing another work placement, this time under Endeavor.
I like the way it presents itself as, hey, it's school. Hey, they're going to work placement, but it's all like crazy fucking high stakes.
Yeah, they do point out in this episode that doing this kind of risks your academic career.
Because even Night Eye said, it's like, yeah, because you're not going to be able to take classes because you're full on here. This isn't a part-time fucking job.
Yeah.
So you will have to presumably do fucking catch up or do night courses.
But it's Deku, so he studies more than is necessary in the first place. So.
Yeah, he's good. He's good. If he has to take summer course, that's probably what he would have done anyway.
It's Red Riot is the one you have to worry about in this front. Cause you assume, the two girls are going to be fine as well. Cause
they're both pretty smart. Yes. So. He's a kind of a fucking
and
itch.
Work really hard, but yes. Whereas he kind of struggles and it's almost as much his story in this arc as it is Deku's. So that's
excellent. I like the character, so I want to see him doing stuff.
That is something to look forward to. And yeah, after the credits, before the credits, we get some discussion of the overhaul is like second command of the Shi Heisei, who are a legal villain organization. So I assume this is some sort of commentary on how Yakuza operate. Is like,
they're operating within the confines of the law, essentially.
Yeah, I did look up a little bit about this. I think in recent years they changed the law so that any crime committed by a member of an organization will lead to the head of the organization being charged. So I think that's
if a guy commits assault, basically you're indicted for letting someone commit assault.
Yes, yeah, so I think that's why specifically Overhaul is the second in command and not in command.
Right, so someone else takes the flag for it.
Yeah, so he probably feels like he can do whatever he's up to with impunity. And yeah, so they're trying to...
Because someone else is getting in trouble for it, sure.
Yeah, so they're trying to figure out, have they done anything illegal? They're suspicious because him and his mates all dressed like plague doctors wandering around town.
Yeah, there's talks of him talking to the League of Villains, but we don't know the specifics.
Yes.
So and Deku's kind of like, oh shit, that's my story coming up. Okay, the plot's rearing its head. All right.
Yes.
So I want you to keep your heads down, keep your eyes open, have a fucking look about just on patrol kind of thing.
Because I mentioned it's like normally this should be the police's job. Because the only thing we've seen them do publicly is they've been beating up other villains.
Maybe that's part okay in the legal villain thing. It's like, well, he did kill a guy, but that guy was like, you know, eating a car or something. You know, it's like, it's probably okay.
And so then you go, oh, the credits are playing awfully early, and then you think, oh, I better stay around. And yeah, so they're out on patrol and this young girl is running away from Overhaul down an alleyway.
Bumps into Deku. He's like, oh, you okay there, little girl? Overhaul's like, hey, thanks for finding my little girl. I'll take her back now.
And so, yes, we don't even get the thought, but you can tell it's like Deku's like, oh, I've been told not to cause any problems, but clearly something bad is happening here.
This is super suspect. A little girl wrapped in bandages, running away scared from the guy we're investigating.
And I just watched a minute and a half of her sad life in the end credits.
So we're a doubly suspect, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a blue-haired girl with bandages on her arms. And the single horn on the head.
I think.
I mean, I know what's going on, but I think it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly.
Okay, fair enough.
Because if I remember correctly, this arc is just a whole lot of fighting.
I'm down for that.
Righty-ho. Then we've got, next on the list is, there's no Detective Conan. But then we've got Welcome to Demon School, Arumakun. Episode 4, The Misfit Class. Oh, I forgot to make a note of all these misfits.
There's actually so many fucking names.
We remember? I can't remember the names, but we've got an owl. He's like the owl version of Benita.
Like, he claims not to be lecherous, but I'm pretty sure, like, he's super lecherous.
Yes, because he was.
He's not as upfront as Manila.
Well, he did ask those girls to crush them under their soft biceps.
Yeah, but then they're like, okay, why do you want to fucking be in my armpit? And he's like, because it'll be fucking hot. And I was like, well, at least he's honest, you know?
Yes. We've got one who's always asleep all the time. There's a guy.
A fuzzy guy with a sword?
Yes, a fuzzy guy with a sword. There's a man with a guy with a lion's head who speaks in weirdly phrased, syntax.
I'm liking the look of that guy. He looks like he's got the head of what was the lion in fucking Bleach called?
Oh yeah, I know who you mean, yes.
But that kind of like star shaped lion mane.
There's a guy who's constantly stealing things.
He says he just can't help it. Not his fault.
There's two women in addition to Clara. We don't get much of an idea about. The one's the one who's in the glasses, constantly worried, who we've seen previously.
The demon girl after Iruma is like really worried because she's like, oh man, I didn't get into his class.
Yes.
Everyone else seems to have gotten in, yeah.
Yeah, and it takes them a while to find the class because it's not in the normal area. You have to go down these steps, down some more steps.
Past the rubbish tip.
Yes. Following this bright green glowing arrow, which Clara is incredibly excited by because she is like some sort of wild animal.
She was following that. I was like, clearly she's following the wrong thing, but no, she was fucking spot on. The glowing arrow was going to their class.
But the important misfit for this episode and the next is Sabdok, the really big guy who wants to be the king of hell. And completely obviously rubs Asmodeus up the wrong way. And I do love their standoff when the Clara is in the background going, wow, he's really big, and then gets this measuring...
Yeah, she's just in the background. Stand out. Figure out how big this guy is.
Yes.
With the meter stick or whatever you call those things.
And that was the point. That, and when she pulls the binoculars out later, is the fact that, oh yeah, her power is just allows for props to be produced.
That's the thing I was thinking as well. And I was just like, well, that's good then. You don't have to explain. It's like, why does she suddenly have it? She has whatever the hell she wants. Whatever she needs to make this thing funny.
And,
which makes it an excellent power.
Yes, and because he was framed for stealing from the tuck shop, Eggy Sensei has been assigned to this class.
It's because he was like caught in a net while all the other classes were, the teachers were assigned. So he got the shit one because it's like everyone else took the non-misfit class, which is hilarious. His life has just really gone to shit.
It is. But I love how excited Clara is to see him and call him Eggy Sensei.
He's like, don't fucking call me that.
And so the first lesson is a cross-country run, essentially.
Because, your man Sabnok explains the power level of demons and, like, the different pronouns you use, I guess, for the level that you're supposed to be at. And the cross-country race and the familiar summoning thing will determine their rank. In the class, I guess.
Yes. And I do like that Clara and Asmodeus show off that they're friends with Aruma. And Sabnok's like...
Yeah, because, Sabnok is kind of like, well, I'm not scared of you because you're like his slave now. And that's not different. It's like, no, I'm his friend. It's like, what's that?
But everyone's...
He makes it into this huge thing.
Everyone's slightly jealous. They're like... And it does seem to be, by the end of the episode, it's like the theme is that in hell, human kindness is super powerful.
human blood is literally magical. So that's what we learn as well. So maybe a bit of humanity inside these demons, though. Yeah.
Yeah, that does definitely. So yeah, they do this cross country run. There's two routes, but they're told they can't use one route because the guardian of that route is in a bad mood and should not use.
Otherwise, it's like this way's the shortcut, but we're not allowed to use that this year because monster. There's a kind of pissy.
Yes, but of course you know, because the interest that Sabnok shows in it means that you know he's going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And the other problem is you've got to fly this route and, Rubicon does not have wings, but.
Initially it's like, it's just a cross country run. And it's like, okay, everyone get ready to fly. And he's like, what? Teacher pushes him off a cliff. It's like, come on already, slacker, and goes to sit down and watch him on the telly. And I find it's like, you nearly killed your student, man.
Well, but I do like his complete lack of care means he does not notice that he hasn't got wings.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I do like how long they leave it before we get to Arumakun's part of the story.
And the fact that most of us told her, like, you might be wondering how we got in this crazy situation. Again, it's a good joke and it's the worst.
Yes. And the fact that Clara hadn't been flying either, she'd just been sitting on Asmodeus's back, seemingly unnoticed for much of the flight.
Yeah, because he was like, how long have you been there? And he's like, let me think, the entire time. I've been here the entire time. good stuff.
So he gets taken by giant birds to, there's lots of birds because he gets taken by like a giant crow. The guy who's constantly nicking stuff nicks a bunch of demon bird eggs thinking he might be able to sell them and then they get pecked by demon birds. Sabnok takes the alternative route, which then leads him to get attacked by the guardian of that route.
It's kind of like an owl bear looking
something thing, like that, like yes.
Or something, yeah.
And then Arubicon ends up in the nest of said beast with its chick, who he ends up healing. Well, initially he's going to try and he like cuts himself and bandages his hand.
Yeah, its leg is injured, and obviously it's like, oh fuck, it's hurting. I thought it was just going to eat me. So he cuts his own hand to show that if he bandages his hand, it'll be better. So he can demonstrate to this thing without language that it's like, that's the right way to do it. And then he accidentally bleeds into it while trying to bandage him up.
Yes, and that instantly heals him. And then he's like, oh.
Makes best friends with it, yeah.
I guess I have superpowers here. And it makes best friends with this bird and it carries him off.
Hmm.
And meanwhile, we leave with Sabnok. The teacher thinks Sabnok has been killed and has already wiped his name off the roster.
He's wiped his name off the roster. He's like, oh, if we're lucky, we'll get like an arm or a leg to, just have full inventory of students, but he's gone. He's probably dead. That's fine.
Yes. So I assume next week we're going to get Aruma and Psamdok bonding, because it looks like in the preview we get some of Psamdok's flashback and
why he wants to be Demon King and why he thinks he's the shonen protagonist.
Yes. But yeah, it was a lot of fun again, and I find this show highly enjoyable every week. I think it's like in the slot that Classicaloid was, or thereabouts.
Okay.
Yeah. On a Saturday on NHK, so.
Not quite the same thing, but yeah, definitely the humor is up anyway.
Yeah, and yeah, I think because it's on NHK, you'd like, well, there's never going to be anything too untoward here. It's not, you're not watching a comedy waiting for a mine to explode in your face of bad taste.
Right, okay, fair enough.
Then we've got Vinland Saga, episode 16, History of Beasts. I almost read that as History of Beats, but it's not.
That'll be a different history lesson from your man,
So this is where I think I mentioned a while back that Ashglad has the speech of, like, you know, you don't even come here in the first place, you Angles, or are you a Saxon? I don't know which one you are.
Yeah, because he, your man's kind of like, you Nords are nothing but beasts. And he's like, if that's the case, we're the beasts that eat the beasts, because you motherfuckers are the guy who fucks shit up.
Yes. And meanwhile, here, have my incredibly rose-tinted vision of Romans.
Oh, they came here and worked with the Celts. Wow, what a bunch of nice guys. My fucking hole they did.
Well, I mean, the Romans' approach to empire building was definitely more sophisticated than the Vikings.
I mean, like, it was often like marry in, work with what's
yes, and it was like
in place, that kind of thing.
You could be local leaders, and you, as long as you're willing to pay taxes, let's have a look at your gods. Oh yeah, it turns out they're also our gods.
Yeah, no, it turns out, see the main god you got there? That's Zeus, who fucking knew? Sorry, not even Zeus, I got the wrong one there, fuck's sake. Easy mistake to make. He goes by many names.
Yes. It's kind of, it was more of an integrate, but yes, kindly, conveniently misses.
I mean,
like
it was easier to integrate prior existing things, and it's weird the way the Catholic Church picked up on that.
But yes, kind of misses out, like, the, the Celts who didn't want to join the Roman Empire. Yeah. Or, say, the Picts.
The who? Yeah.
But as I say, it's many, many, many years, and obviously we've established that, like, yeah, the Welsh kings at this point, in order to, say that they've gone from the Romans to the Britons at this point with the ON.
Yeah.
So, but this is Ashgalad's worldview coming through, and it's been increasingly not the worldview of his men.
Yeah, it's both his, voice, I guess, coming out, like you say, worldview, but then the counter to that is, it's kind of turning everyone against him.
Yeah, well, the other problem is, here's Thorkell. Well, that's later, much later on in the story, where that actually happens, but.
I know, but he does announce himself fairly obviously here, and that's a bit of a.
By hurling a pike through four people.
I mean, like, the big fucking shit-eating grin he has after that, he knows exactly what he did. And it wasn't just stab four people with the same fucking spear. It was, it's like, oh, that's really gonna fuck with him now.
Yeah, cause
like,
he
halfway through this episode, he's like, when, you know, they're, like, some guys are trying to defect, some of Ascalad's guys are trying to defect him. It's like, oh, don't worry, we're not like Ascalad. We want to join you, Thorkell. Thorkell's just chopping up. It's like, so, the guy I'm chasing is Ascalad, eh? I'm learning all kinds of things today.
So his essential orders are to kill everybody apart from Canute and Thorfinn, his playmate.
His friend.
Yes.
Playmate, yeah.
Meanwhile, so they've got to this bridge. Ascalad's plan is, we'll take the bridge down. The guys are like, this is a very shallow river. They could just cross with it.
Yeah, we're just walking across to do it. And he's like, yeah, but they won't be able to bring their carts across. And then they'll only be able to chase us for a day before they have to stop and get food. And that'll slow them down in the long run. It's not entirely wrong as a plan, but since they've been marching for days and days and days, it seems like okay, so now we're going to stop marching, chop down a bridge, and then march some more.
But this is also so Ashgalad can get a proper idea of, like, exactly how many people...
The lay of the land, yeah.
For or against him. And he kind of figures out, well, I better put the only three people I can trust in this one wagon and make sure they can go ahead.
It's funny that Thorfinn is like one of the guys he can trust because he knows how he will react.
Yes.
But he's not on your side, but you know what he'll do in a given situation. You can read him, I guess is the way he puts it. Yeah.
Yeah, when they're trying to flee at the start of the episode, Canute wants, four people. The priest is on there as well. But he wants to bring Ragnar and
he wants to have a funeral and proper burial rites, and they're like, don't get time, Thorkell's here.
And so Ashglass slaps him, and you like, then you look deep into Canute's eye and you're like, is he realizing there that Ashglass the one who killed Ragnar?
I feel like that's what they're implying, yeah. Cause he's like, you son of a bitch. It's like, oh, he fought bravely, but then he got stabbed in the back. What are you gonna do? It's all a bit too convenient. And even fucking Ascalad, his man, walking around is like, hey, do you think you really should have killed a guy? Ascalad's like, shut up. Not everyone fucking knows that. Everyone's just like, yeah, it's obvious he killed him.
Yeah, and the friars run out of booze as well.
Yeah.
Another important plot point this episode. but yeah, it's all beginning to fall apart. Flashland, and it ends with him being surrounded by his own men.
Oh, we got the name of those two brothers as well, because they are conspiring under the bridge, or one of them is conspiring to try and get the other brother and the rest of the men on their side of, let's fucking leave while we can. And he's kind of like, yeah, listen, I like Ascalad, he's a good leader, but, you know, too many fuck-ups, what are you going to do? We got to live.
Yeah, his luck's going to run out. This bit did remind me of Red Dead Redemption 2, where...
We're just one more time, yeah. We'll have it again. You know, it's just like, yeah, sure, but...
So we leave them with a cliffhanger of his men about to turn on him with Thorkell breathing down his neck. What will happen next?
It's weird the way for like a episode where they're just kind of going, where they're trying to get the lay of the land with regards to men, and also just slowly not really get away, but just keep the distance between them and certain doom of Thorkell. But it's interesting to kind of see it develop and how that's making the characters change.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get some big changes as things go along.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got...
Oh, and yeah, there was a torture sequence as well where Ascalad is being a horrible monster.
Yes.
Kind of living up to the expectation.
Just saying. Oh, I don't know. You haven't got this episode titled out. Did you watch it? Babylon episode 4.
Oh, do I not have it down? That's bizarre. I don't have it down. Babylon episode 4, it was called Target.
That's
why
it.
I don't have it in though. Strange.
So. Let's do some police work.
Yeah, not a big cliffhanger or anything, just kind of like, here's the setup, here's how we're going to do it. We need to not frame this guy, we need to figure out what crimes, if any, this guy committed, and then find him and arrest him, so I'm going to need a big team for this.
Yeah, so they've got until, so there's still the election for the new city. To take place.
Yeah, so the election for the mayor is in, but the placement for the city council?
Yeah.
Is a few days after, like, they've got, what, 12 days or something?
Yes. And so they're trying to figure out where the mayor is, so they can charge him with,
eventually. The only charge they have right now is abetting suicide?
That's it, yes.
Yeah.
They've got, like.
Technically, he's done nothing wrong other than that.
And so they're bringing in people from the public prosecution office, from the police, and he wants one guy from the sexual crimes division as well.
Yeah, they're all kind of like, really? Also, he's got a new secretary, which makes me think, is like, is that your one?
I think that is the intention of the story, is to make you and him.
Not trust women, I guess.
Yes.
That's fucking sure.
Because he's definitely hiding things from her.
Yeah.
In having conversations away from her and the final
and having
thing.
Certain conversations in front of her.
Yes. Yeah. And, the guy, is it the guy that he said to look into, I think I say the one who's actually looking into Itsuki?
Oh, the ball guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like he's doing something different than what he told him to do.
Yes.
But related.
But because that's the call he takes away from her.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm like, are we, the viewer, supposed to think that he's gone so paranoid that he thinks that any woman could possibly be I?
She can transform into different women, at least three different women, possibly more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, also it's very careful to never have her with her uncle in the same scene.
Yeah, because he's saying, like, it's weird for me to say that name, because that's your uncle's name, and he's, like, the head of the thing, and she's like, yeah, just get used to it kind of thing. She's very tactful, and the most he'll say about her to anyone else is, like, oh, she doesn't like me, that kind of thing. But I feel like we're supposed to be, it's supposed to make us paranoid about his potential paranoia.
Yes.
I suppose deserved paranoia at this fucking stage.
Yes, because she does nothing, if anything, she's more by the book than he is.
Yeah, he even compliments her in front of her to his friend, where it's like, wow, she's way more useful than that last guy who died. Which is a bit cold-hearted, but again, I'm like, was that on purpose? Are you trying to get a rise out of her? And she keeps looking over at him, so it's like, if she isn't the woman he's looking for, I've forgotten her name now.
Imagase.
If she isn't that woman, then she definitely has some beef with him. And that she could be still like another pawn in the scheme, like another thing to make him paranoid. Make him look the wrong direction, essentially.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Itsuki is doing his own things of, like, releasing these videos. He's going to put it to the public.
He just puts them up on YouTube or something.
Yes, he's no longer in the videos, which makes you think, is he even alive?
That's the thing I was considering. Like, was the last thing he fucking recorded the mayoral election speech of last episode? And then after that, I'm like, we literally have a master of disguise, so there's no reason she couldn't disguise her voice. So, yeah.
And yeah, the election essentially is the election is now essentially to ratify the law he's brought in.
Our Donald Trump guy is kind of coming in as like, well, I'm fucking running against him then, because he put in three clauses, and they're very fucking interesting clauses as to the election, how it'll work in the city. So the first one is,
Anyone resident in
Isekai? No, it's anyone. Any resident of Isekai? Isekai?
Shikai, I think.
Shikai. Sorry, must be mixing up my things. Shikai can vote, but it doesn't state how long a residency is. So anyone who's fucking there can vote. Also, doesn't state any age. The parents of kids could potentially vote twice for their kids as well.
Yeah, you can vote online.
Yeah, that's a worry.
And anyone can run as well. Anyone qualified for voting can also run.
So yeah, the exact same qualifications for voting is the exact same qualifications for running.
So babies could run.
No age limit on that either. Yeah.
And there's a viral video of a son in a Sentai mask worried that his dad's going to commit suicide and is pleading people to vote in the election to make sure this law doesn't come into pass.
And they're looking at the opinion polls regarding his suicide thing, and it's mostly like people against suicide, because I mean those are the laws in most of Japan except for this one part, but there's like 3% of people who are in favor of it, and the cop determines like that's probably people thinking about euthanasia, because obviously that's a thing that is justifiable suicide, but this is a little different situation here. And I'm like, the way they're showing me those numbers, I feel like there's something they're not fucking telling me, you know what I mean?
Well, they think it'll grow.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
They think it will grow, and they point out that because the way the election's set up is that it's going to be fought entirely on that one subject. Oh, which,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Like, little too close to home living in the UK of an election fought entirely on one subject.
This must be very worrying for you. I like the idea, like the way he's managed to make that. That's the third stipulation of the election. Like all the candidates need to announce publicly their stance on the suicide law. And the mayor doesn't have a party, so he doesn't have any support. But by anyone announcing, even if he only gets 3% of people running announcing, he's already made himself a party. He's made it an us against them thing. He's made it based on this fucking one issue as well. So. He really, like, it seems like he doesn't have the raw numbers for it, but he has control over the situation in a bunch of regards.
And again, you have to remind yourself as the viewer is that there's still things from early on in the story that haven't been addressed yet because it's always being driven by what the people higher up to our main character want him to investigate.
Like, basically, okay, now you're working on the fucking, now you're trying to catch the mayor. It's like, what about that drug thing from before? It's like, never mind that drug thing from before. Forget about it. God damn it.
Yeah.
He's like chasing the fucking tail, but he's kind of missing out on the whole fucking picture. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a really good show. Even though, I mean, the animation's a little wonky in places, but I said the direction's always top notch, regardless of what some of the drawings look like.
Again, my only flaw with this one is there's no real denouement at the end of it. It's more so let's set up what is going to happen. I mean, like, I could be wrong. Like, context in this episode might change later down the line.
He's looking at some sort of physical files about I Magase, which were, I think, on the same USB drive that they recovered from the doctor who'd committed suicide in episode one.
That's one of the things where she's like, hey, what's on that drive? And he's like, nothing?
Bad data, he says.
Yeah. So either he means he's being literally saying it's incorrect, or he's, again, trying to keep stuff from her.
So I think that's the same file. Because I think that's the only USB drive which has been introduced into the story. And that was where they found out the information about the drug which makes people commit suicide.
But I suppose if it had information on a patient that didn't know her name beforehand, now that it takes on new relevance,
not make you commit suicide. It's a sleeping drug you should never wake up from.
It lets you commit suicide very easily.
Yes.
I think is the way you'd put it, yeah.
Right, on to simpler fare. Let's rewind back from Sunday night to Sunday mornings with Kamen Rider 01, episode 9, I Will Take Care of That Life. Well, I say simpler fare. I'm not sure it is that much simpler. It's fairly similar to Babylon, to be honest. But
oh, dear. Okay.
So, previously, the bad guys had stolen the giant robot, the Geiger. They'd used it to hack into the cyber hospital and turn various humor gears bad. And also they'd blown up, Kamen Rider Vulcan. And now he's opening this with him in the hospital being treated. They've got the humor gears back online again. They have a, big old, debate fight in the streets between 01 and, the terrorists. We get some newscaster characters introduced who are saying, ah, when the human gears get hacked, their eyes turn red. I was like, ah, I had not noticed that throughout the rest of this.
I feel like that would be a fairly obvious thing for cyborgs to... Or not cyborgs, robots.
So if you see a human gear's eyes turn red, run away. Meanwhile, the vice president is like, oh, this is a crisis. The hospital got hacked. We're going to have to deactivate all the humor gear medical professionals. And so now it's like, oh, Vulcan's going to die because there's no one to do surgery on him. So then
robot surgeons are turned off. Okay.
Yeah. Then Valkyrie, she runs to see 01 and says, you've got to turn those humor gears back on. And I know I've not been entirely nice to you. And he agrees. Yeah, he switches more back on. And the vice president's like, haha, right, now, if anything goes wrong, it's going to be his fault and I can take his position. meanwhile, she gives Izu, the secretary, Human Gear, the stolen power-up thing the bad guys use.
Oh, the, what do you call them, keys or something?
Yeah, the Extinguise keys are theirs. So she scans it and she goes, oh yeah, there's something similar. We've got something similar to the Geiger. It's attached to the satellite. And they're like, hiding and developing weapons as well. And they go, no, it's for, rescue, search and rescue. That's what it's for. Cause that's the other thing is that she blames herself because, the weapons she'd been developing were used against Vulcan, so that's why she's... So now, yes, they've got their own mammoth power-up now, which the back end of the satellite detaches and comes to Earth, and then 01 climbs into it.
That seems a bit more complicated than Brother Eye type situation.
Yeah, he's got a giant robot now.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So then you get a giant robot fight. And meanwhile, Vulcan's being healed by Human Gears, so that's taking place. So they set the terrorists back, so the end of the world hasn't quite ended yet. Then another news report comes in of like video of, here's a Human Gear who's turning bad on his own accord. His eyes didn't turn red. He was blue. And then Izu's like, that happened when in the fight, the last episode. Where were you during that fight? And then she reconstructs the scene in her head and goes, you were the one taking the video. Why were you taking the video? And then Valkyrie's like, thanks, kind of goes, no, it wasn't me. And she storms out. So what is she up to? I'm going to guess her, it wasn't me, is because she was being ordered by whoever the next bad guy's going to turn out to be.
Right.
And now Vulcan is conflicted, you see, because he says, I've got two memories now about Human Gears. I've got one of them destroying my town and attacking me, and now I've got another memory of them saving my life. And so, yeah, he's now realizing that his hatred is just that. He's going to have to take each Human Gear as they come, rather than judging them all as a whole. And then Aruto does his catchphrase, and it makes him laugh and then cry because he's still stitched up. And also he's a cop, and he can't admit that he finds this guy's jokes funny. I assume that is how it's going to end. I assume that's the final episode, is that he's finally happy to laugh out loud. Next week, Human Gear actors, and a real actor who I assume is probably somebody, if I was in Japan, I'd recognize.
Right.
Maybe from an old tokusatsu. He's got, say, like, I'm in my 60s, but I used to play a superhero in my 70s type face.
Okay.
And as we don't have Star Twinkle Pretty, I can't give you a gap before we go to Rio Soga. But the bad guys essentially save Nada by accident. I mean, the good guys have to do a lot as well. But
okay.
Creon is bullied, and his sidekicks are bullied by the Admiral again. And so this time he just uses one of his sidekicks to make a Minosaur. And it creates like a jack-o'-lantern Minosaur who drains hate out of humans, which then goes into a giant storm cloud and rains hate back down onto humans.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, that sounds like a good thing, but...
Well, it turns out to be a good thing, because they realize that Nada is being corrupted by the hate of the Geysolg armor. And then the green member of the team realizes, okay, the armor is always looking for somebody strong. So all I have to do is beat Nada up to the inch of his life, and then the armor will leave him. And then
a Venom type situation.
Yeah. And while the armor's leaving him, we can use the power of the Minosaur to absorb all the hate from the armor and save Nada. And so that is what they do. Ko, the Red Ranger, offers himself up to Geysorg. And so he gets some of the armor on him, which releases the hate. And then they kind of fend off the rest of the remaining pieces of the armor so he doesn't get taken over. Meanwhile, P-Tan and Tiramigo were getting into arguments earlier, but then P-Tan says to Tiramigo, hey, do you want to fly? And they combine, and they go in search of the Minosaur. They bring the Minosaur back down to Earth. They use its power. They save Nada. They beat the Minosaur up in the new ultimate combination of P-Tan, Tiramigo, the dad punching dinosaur, and its son punching dinosaur.
I've seen that one. It like rides in like a kangaroo.
It does, yes. And it tends to leap off the combined robot to then punch the monster as they're finishing it off, which it did again this time.
Just get a little dig in. Yeah, okay.
It's because P-Tan was trying to show off in front of Tiramigo earlier about how much it knew about Geysorg. That's when they got into their argument. But P-Tan, yeah, he took Tiramigo for a fly, and they were buddies again, because Tiramigo's annoyed at, I assume that all of the dinosaurs must be annoyed at P-Tan, because he was the one who avoided being sealed. Because he just flew into the sky. That was what happened. When whatever the spirit who's possessing the dad was sealing all the Dino Knights, P-Town didn't want to be sealed, so he flew into the sky.
He got away, yeah.
Yeah, and then ran into a bad guy who then sealed him as an egg. And I'm assuming that bad guy is with us next week, because there's a new bad guy and he's beating up all the Reosolgers. Except our new Reosolger, Nada, who can now wear the Geysolg armor without being evil. Because it's been drained of its hate. So there's now 7 of them. And presumably no more.
That's as many as it tends to be, isn't it?
Well, yeah. The last space one had a crazy amount of people in it.
Okay.
And the last dinosaur one had a lot of people in it as well.
Fair
enough. Because that one had, like, people who had died and came back as ghosts. And he had Shigeru Chiba briefly as the purple one, and then that character's granddaughter took over the role.
Okay.
I can't remember the space one's name, and I did like it. It was really good. That did a really good job of having loads of people. And also a bit like this, it had the case of the youngest actor was possibly the best actor.
Because they've been doing it.
Well, kind of, but the thing the space one had as well was it had loads of aliens in it. So it had a lot of the characters were suit actors played by anime voice actors as the voice.
Right.
So that would tended to be a pretty good combination as well.
Yeah.
Because quite often the people in the suits are better actors than the people out of the suits.
Well, you gotta emote through the rubber.
Exactly. Because you watch this episode and the guy playing Ko, I'm sure he's a nice chap, but his grin is so tortuous and pasted on when he's trying to smile for the camera.
Is he very, very pretty though? Because that might be helping him out.
He's not super pretty.
Okay.
But I guess I don't know. I mean, I'm not a Japanese mum being forced to watch this on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, you're not the demographic for that then, yeah.
But he seems like the Nada character, I assume, is the appropriate age for the mums watching, everyone else. And maybe the Bamba character as well.
Right.
Everyone else is too young and some of them are legally too young.
Oh dear.
Well, I think only the green one. I think he's the guy who's only 16. But yeah, he's pretty good at acting as well. He's the, of everyone emoting in this episode, he was probably the one doing the best emoting. The little sister character got rained on by the hate rain, so she got to play like a delinquent.
Oh, she got chew the scenery a bit.
Yeah, she got an insult. She was insulting, Melto, the one she's in love with. And, it was completely destroying his personality to hear these insults.
Good stuff.
So yeah, the Pink Ranger had to pick her up and drag her off. I don't know how she was then asleep later on, so I don't know whether she just knocked her out, because we never saw how she was asleep.
Can't go on the head off screen, could be.
No, because last time you saw her, she was like over the shoulder, still stamping her little fists on the back of the Pink Ranger. But yeah, I don't know there's the outside chance she might get to turn into a ranger, I guess, would be the remaining chance of another member. Or possibly some of the bad guys turning face.
They seem to be like fun enough and nice enough that would make sense, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming the one who turns up next week is the one who the worst one of the bad guys was afraid of.
Yeah, like he's the worst bad guy.
So. Yes, yeah. The tone may change and maybe the modus operandi of how each episode goes.
Sure.
Might as well. Give it up on One Piece.
I have. I'll come back to it in a bit and I'll catch the highlights because I was like, I'll watch the pilot or whatever the hell you want to call it. But I said I'll leave it on.
And then finally, it's Gegege no Kitaro, Komori Neko's Halloween Pandemonium, in which Nozomi Otoko is finally back to being Nozomi Otoko.
Yeah, no, full on it. He not only teams up with a prior existing bad guy, but does so in order to screw that guy out of money. Exactly him, yeah.
So, yes, our bad guy is Komori Neko, who is a part cat, part bat.
A cat cat, bad or a bad cat.
Who's rolled up at Halloween to drain the Japanese of their blood so he can revive Backbeard.
Yep, he's working for Backbeard, and it's like, ooh, this is going to be a big deal. It's like, no, he's like super minor guys. The other main guys we've seen before don't even know his name. He's that far down the ranking.
He is. And so Nozomi Otoko runs a con on him. In return for gold, he'll get him all the Japanese blood he wants by setting up a phony blood donor clinic.
I think he printed up the posters and everything. This guy seems legit.
He got an office. But then he just gives him a bottle of tomato juice.
That he drains, like, there when Tomorrow Neko was distracted, essentially, which is like, that dude, you could have done this beforehand. Very lazy.
And then gets the rest of his gold, and then just walks off with it. does not do anything else.
He basically brings him to an empty lot, going like, no, I'll totally bring all of Japan's blood here, just give me 5 minutes. He's like, you'll never see me again.
But Kimori Deko is very happy, and so he's going to decide, I'll just drink a little bit of this blood, even though I'm not supposed to.
That's grand. I'm going to have loads of blood in a minute, so I'll basically be ruling Japan for Backbeard-sama. It'll be grand.
But oh no, this isn't blood. And then he goes back to the office and finds the cans of tomato juice.
He does hunt down Nozomi Otoko, and I did like, I wonder how many times he's pulled this on monsters, and I assume a bunch. But he's like, hey, you know, Kiro, that's my best friend. He'll kick your ass if you come after me.
Yeah, because I feel like it was like some very specific. I wonder if this is a specific version of a con, because there's also the line about he's going to make him the head of a underworld organization.
Yeah, yeah.
That was like so specific. I was like, hey, I mean, if this was ripped from the headlines even now or in the past from the original story.
Yeah, or he could be trying to run the same con that he ran before, I suppose.
Yeah. And this leads him to, he ends up in a Halloween contest where the crowd get behind him, and then
everyone thinks he's a kid in a costume that's totally like into the character he's created, and they're all just like, woo, they're all drunken louts, essentially, much like Kachik was saying.
Yes. It
fills him with power, all this support he's getting. Even if it's drunken support, it still counts.
There's a lot of lines in this which made me just feel it was whoever was writing the script this week does not like Halloween and had a chance for the characters to voice that.
Yeah, and the way it ends is just like, oh, time to go back to work, and everyone just fucks off. I was just like, okay, you clearly don't like the holiday then.
Or doesn't like amateur drinkers. That could also be the, yeah.
I suppose that could be it as well, because, yeah, we do see the cloth going, hearing about cosplay, and he's like, oh, fuck, oh, that sounds great. And the crybaby old man is kind of like, it's like drinking. I'm there for that. Kidoro gets informed of it because on their fucking walking around binge drinking, they kind of overhear Nozomi Otoko and a mysterious yokai, blah, 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 Blackbeard, blah, 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 Blackbeard-sama, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, fuck, they're saying Blackbeard. We better go tell Kidoro, but they're too drunk to remember any other details about what happened.
Yes. And that is my favorite sequence of animation, is the sandwich beating the pair of them up.
They did lovingly render that, yeah.
And then they get in a fight, and he's been made more powerful because he's got the belief of the crowd behind him. But yeah, once they go home, then his power dissipates.
The sun comes up and Halloween's magic ends. They're like, oh, fuck, I got work in the morning. Time to go. And like, he's doing all the cool things. Like, he's getting hurt, but then the hurt is instantly not working. He's grabbing street signs and smashing them into Kidoro. But all it takes is like one shoe to knock him out then, basically.
And then we think, oh, that was a funny episode. Entirely harmless villain sent back on his way. And then we see, oh no, that one well-designed vampire cosplay earlier on in the episode.
See, initially I was like, either that's the vampire character or that's just horny animators being horny. It's hard to know sometimes. But it was foreshadowing, as it turns out, yeah.
Yes, I can't remember her name now.
I'm so bad with names.
I'm so tired, so I'm not even going to try to engage my brain.
The vampire from Blackbeard's army before. Yes. The one who ran a movie. Wait, did she do that on Halloween?
She did, yes. She was in the last Halloween episode.
Okay, she's just the Halloween character then, I guess.
Yes, no, she was actually here successfully recovering a single barrel of blood.
I mean, I guess she got a lot of guys, I think, yes, was the idea, because even a lot of people waking up in the morning and hungover is like, oh my god, what the hell, I must have fallen asleep, and then they all have neck punctures. Eventually. Yes.
And, they're going to awaken Blackbeard, and we see during, as the credits close, his eye begin to open.
Dun, dun, dun. A few more barrels of blood.
So, yeah, now we've got two of his greatest villains.
Teaming up, hopefully.
I wonder if Nurion's going to defeat Blackbeard as, like,
he's very pro-Japan. Yeah. Yes.
Do you see? I'm the one you should trust, not Kitaro. Kitaro couldn't get rid of Blackbeard fully.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. That's my suspicion of where the story's going, but having said that, I don't know any previous instances where this story has happened before. Anyway, if Blackbeard's coming back, there's a chance we get the racing, the race episode where they race each other and Blackbeard's in his little car.
That sounds rad as heck, so I'm all for that.
We shall see. Righty-ho, that is everything all done and dusted within a lot less time than normal.
Cutting some stuff out, kind of trimmed about a little. We'll get there. We'll get it down to a tight half hour one of these days.
Righty-ho, we will be back here next week with more Let's Go. Goodbye.